True North stores have Primo Eats and Pepsi brand products that are heavy on taste and light on your wallet. Right now, buy any Primo sandwich and add a 20-ounce Pepsi brand beverage for just $1. Handmade every day, Primo uses quality meats and cheeses. Complete the meal with a Pepsi. Grab any Primo sandwich and pair it with a 20-ounce Pepsi brand beverage for just $1. Get more with the True Rewards mobile app. Available in your app store. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So, you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapjacks.
Those aren't even the words.
I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks. RSNs available with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package.
Nerds!
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Are target date funds a smart or lazy way to invest? Should you pay off debt or invest extra cash? Can you deduct your dog as a home security system on your taxes? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing strategies, tax planning, and smart ways to build wealth and navigate big financial decisions. Work smarter, not harder, on your finances this year. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen. What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Kobe White, Eaton Rim here in Orlando. Oh my goodness, the Magic Kingdom will never be the same.
Kobe White, Eastern Conference Player of the Week.
Kobe White drives it into Wagner.
Oh, nice hesitation.
A season high, an official career high, tying 37 points. Kobe White. Good!
That's us, Kobe White.
A new career high, 42.
Ooh, Kobe White is on fire.
Coming in hot, Kobe White, back-to-back Eastern Conference Player of the Week. That hasn't happened since Michael Jordan.
Kobe over the midcourt line, 4 seconds to go. Kobe comes up shooting on Westbrook, deep three, bam! Oh my goodness, Kobe White, big time onions!
We're hearing Kobe White chants from the fans that have made the trip over to Ball Arena. The Bulls fans are chanting Kobe White's name.
This is the Kobe White Show. This franchise now belongs to Kobe White.
2-point game, 9.8 left. Oh, who spoke, Diddy? The steal! White for the lead! Yes!
Big time plays! Big time plays! Kobe White! Sub-zero! Bang!
And Bulls guard Kobe White was named the Kia NBA Player of the Month in the East for games played in March. White joins Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Derrick Rose, Jimmy Butler, and DeMar DeRozan as the only players to earn that monthly honor.
DeMar was a guy that gave the group great belief that we could win. And I think Kobe's done the same thing.
I love it. I mean, it's exciting to see. Always tease him. You know, I told him the other day, congrats. You know, just rooting for him.
From North Carolina, a 6'5 guard, number 0.
Kobe!
It is Kobe White joining us on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaLasVegas.com. Kobe, that was a heck of a montage. Those moments that stand out to you, what can you say about the streak that you've been on to be able to earn Eastern Conference Player of the Month? Congratulations.
Thank you. I just, you know, I can always say I'm super blessed and fortunate to be in the situation. I'll try not to take, you know, these moments for granted. Like I say, I give a lot of credit to my teammates, to the coaching staff, continue to push me to be better on and off the court each and every day. For, you know, Billy Coach to continue to help me grow as a leader and continue to strive to be the player that I want to become. So, like I said, I give all the thanks to my Lord and Savior. I continue to give him all the glory. Without him, none of this is possible. So I'm just super grateful and thankful, you know, for me to be in this situation that I'm in this moment.
Kobe, take me back to the beginning of this year, maybe as a reflection on last year and the growth that you showed when you were right there in the running for most improved player in the NBA. I'm just curious, is this something that you envisioned the way you've played in the second half of the season once Zach departed? And, you know, it was squarely on your shoulders, not the first time Zach's been out and you've had to pick up your game and take it to another level. But did you envision this much success in the back half of the season?
I wouldn't say I envisioned this much because, for the most part, I always tell people, I kind of take, this season is so long, there's so many games, I take it one day at a time. I don't like kind of look towards the future or anything like that. I try to be in the moment and what does my team need right now? What do I have to do in order to help my team succeed? And I kind of, you know, like a lot of opportunity opened up, just to be honest, when Zach left, just because of the type of player he was. So there was a lot of responsibility on all of us to take our games to another level. And I think you've seen it not only with me, but with everybody else on the team, especially, you know, with Josh, adding additions, you know, Trey, Herder, mm-hmm. and DT's been playing really well. Zach Collins came. He's been playing extremely well. So I wouldn't say it's all been on me. You know, I think a lot of us have all stepped up in a new role, and I think we're seeing to take advantage of it, each and every one of us individually.
Yeah, you can definitely tell, Kobe. And one of the things that I always appreciate about you, you know, is even when I've talked to you on the court after the games, you're always kind of surprised by your stats sometimes. I do feel like you take things pretty much individual play by individual play. But it's that level of focus that I think has really gotten you to this point. What would you say about just how much you're focusing on what you know your shot profile is, what you know your shots can be, even the level of focus it took, you know, from that steal from Giddey to kick it out to you to be able to stay in that game against the Lakers?
Yeah, I think coach is always hard on getting lost in the game, getting lost in the moment, and just play free. Oh, wow, Derrick Rose just walked in. It's the practice facility.
Breaking news.
Yeah, this is crazy. But I think just taking it one play at a time, taking it one possession at a time, and, you know, never getting too high, never getting too low, just being even. I think that level of detail is something I've carried over, you know, from even off the court, is how I live my life, just being one moment at a time, taking it one day at a time. So for me, that's kind of how I've been looking at it. And that's kind of how this season I wanted to come in and focus on, you know, taking it one play at a time. Don't worry about missing or making shots. Don't worry about turning up. Like, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to miss shots. You're going to, you know, do stuff that you're going to look back on and say, like, that wasn't smart. But for me, I think just getting lost in the game, but also just taking it one play at a time and then leaving the pass in the past. So if I turn it over, if I do miss a shot, you know, obviously try not to turn it over again, but that play is over with. Like, that possession is over with. So continue to move on from it and then just get lost in the game.
I noticed, like, your body language has changed. You talked about playing free, and I remember when you hit the shot at the end of the half the other night, and you're hopping on one leg, and I was like, oh, this game's over. Kobe's got this. It's all good. What's your confidence level like right now on a night-to-night basis? I know you had a rough night, as did the team the other night against Oklahoma City, arguably the best team in the league, but you bounced back nicely with the win of Toronto. I just want to know what your confidence level is like right now, and has it ever been this high since you've been a basketball player?
Yeah, I think my confidence level is at a really good level right now. I think for me, it's just what has helped me a lot. Like, I always give my teammates the credit, but like, just the feel, the vibe we have with the team, our level of connectedness has really, like, you know, helped me. It's kind of, you know, reminded me of, like, early on days of playing basketball with, like, in, like, high school and in college, that type of atmosphere with the guys. And like I said, everybody's super close. And, like, we continue to instill confidence in each other, and that's the main thing. I think each and every one of us instill confidence in each other to go out there and be ourselves. And that has helped me a lot. Just, you know, everyone continue to push me. You know, guys on the team continue to talk to me at the games about, you know, I need to be more aggressive or I need to do this. And honestly, that's what really has helped me a lot. Like I said, like, I think when Trey came over here from San Antonio after the trade, I remember we had beat Toronto. It was a game we had beat Toronto where we had the comeback in the fourth quarter. And he texted me after the game. It was kind of like, good game, good job tonight, but you need to shoot more. You need to be more aggressive. We need you to be more aggressive. And Taylor also told me the same thing like 2 games later. And I think when your coaching staff and the people around you tell you need to be more aggressive, like, it's cool. But like, whenever your peers and your teammates all give you that like leeway, like, we need you to be aggressive, we need you to, you know, hunt more shots, that kind of went a long way with me. And it kind of changed my mindset on, you know, the season and what my team needs from me. So those moments helped me a lot.
We are happy to be talking to Coby White, the Eastern Conference Player of the Month here on The Score. And Coby, I think that's great because you always struck me as somebody who's really self-aware. Like, you want to make sure everybody has opportunities. That's part of your personality. That's part of how you facilitate. So was that a big change for you to tell yourself, I need to be this guy more, I need to be more ball dominant, or like shoot more, when you're hearing guys like Trey say that to you, for example?
Yeah, because I think the mindset I had was more so like, you know, like you said, like, I'm trying to make sure everybody has the opportunity. Everybody has that equal opportunity. Everybody, you know, and things like that. So it was different for me at first. And then I knew I started to have to change my mindset whenever Zach left, but it was different for me at first. But those guys kind of helped me realize, like, all right, this is real. And this is how I need to transform my mental in order, you know, for us to continue to help, for me to help my team win games. So, and then after that, it kind of flipped to my mentality to be more aggressive and, you know, hunt for more opportunities within the offense. And then that came with breaking down, like, sitting with our player development staff, sitting with Coach Dan Craig, and it came down to sitting like, all right, what are ways I can get myself easy baskets? Like, how can I get to the free throw line more? How can I get out and transition more? How are other teams, you know, how have they been guarding in the past 5 games? What do I need to look for going against this team? Like, certain things like that. So it kind of broke down to where I could have more opportunities to get myself easy baskets and baskets to hunt more shots. So it's been good, though. You know what I'm saying? So,
Coby, I'm curious, because it's that time of year. There's 6 games left. I want to know how closely you are following the standings and what the Miamis, the Orlandos, and the Hawks are doing. You've already clinched a play-in spot, but I know you've been in that play-in situation before. You want to get to the playoffs. How closely are you guys following not only what the teams around you are doing, but just how many games left and how reasonable it is that you can climb up the standings?
Yeah, you know, we pay attention to a little bit, obviously, just because, you know, it's that time of the year. And we obviously want to try to, you know, have the play-in game at home. But like I said, like, for me, I continue to try to take it one game at a time. I know Miami is on the 6-game winning streak. They've been playing really good ball right now. And we have too, but we just got to continue to focus on us and continue to get better and take every opportunity we have, take fully advantage of it to get better and take steps in the right direction as a team. So,
one of the things that I really appreciated, Coby, was when you shared with Chuck Swirsky how your mentality was trying to go from good to great, and how when you're growing up and you're coming up, whether it's high school, AAU, college, that a lot of times you're not working on the fine-tuned points of your shot, for example. You're not working on the arc of it. You're not working on the mechanics because you're successful at that level already. I appreciate the mentality that you discussed with wanting to get better. What can you tell us about your mentality and your thought process when you decided you really wanted to work on some things with Peter Patton that I think helped you even get to this point right now where you get this accolade?
Yeah, I think just for me, in order for me, like, my whole life to get where I'm at, I've always just had to get better. Like, I always tell people, like, I'm pretty tall, but I wasn't gifted with, like, long arms or, like, you know, like, I tell people all the time, the people in the NBA, like, if you're, like, built average, like an average person, then like, it's kind of a knock against you. So, like, one of the things that coming out in the draft that, like, teams were worried about, that they was talking to me about, actually, I never heard it before. They kind of said, do you think the way you're built is going to have an impact on you defensively? Like, and I was like, what do you mean? And they was kind of like, you know, you don't have long arms. You don't have the highest vertical. You're not, you know what I'm saying? So, like, that's the first time I was like, oh, like, so this is real. Like, you know, so for me, it's like, everything I've got in my life, I had to work for it. And so for me, any way that I can get better, I always try and find ways to get better. And I knew, especially working with Peter Patton, I knew him coming here, the reputation that he had, I knew that I wanted my shot to continue to get better and fine tune my shot. And, you know, at first, like I always say, I'll tell people, he was very kind of reluctant of it because he was like, you already got a good shot. You already got a shot. I said, I know, but I want to get better. Like, I want to have a better shot. I want to reach a level that you know, higher than this. Like, I want to just continue to keep getting better. So after a while, he kind of started, you know, he heard what I said and he started working with me. So he's been great, man. He's been a big help in my career, not only this year, but last year. Not only on the court, off the court, like, he's a guy that I always can talk to. In that whole room, like, I give credit to, you know, Peter Patton, Peter Crawford, Austin Dufault, LD. Like, those guys continue to help me each and every day get to where I want to get to, so.
How does it feel when you were able to not just put it together and see your improvement last year, but see what you've just done when you know you put in that work?
Yeah, I mean, it feels great. Like I said, it's a blessing. It's a blessing. The one thing that I always tell people is, like, you can work your hardest and stuff still might not flip. You know, stuff still might not change for you. But you can't let that derail you from, you know, the next offseason of working hard. You can't go into the next offseason saying, well, you know, this didn't happen this year, so I ain't going to work as hard. You got to work twice as harder. So for me, it's just, it's a blessing because not everyone gets to see the work pay off. You know what I'm saying? Not everyone gets to see it pay off. So I don't take it for granted. And I'm fortunate, you know, to see it pay off. And, you know, I just got to continue to get better, continue to focus on getting better each and every day. So,
Kobe, you were averaging 18 points a game before the All-Star break. Now you're averaging 25 points a game after the All-Star break. Almost at the same time, simultaneously, we saw Josh Giddey go from averaging 12 points before the All-Star break. He's nearly averaging a triple-double, 21 points a game, 9.9 rebounds, 9.1 assists per game. What has that chemistry been like with him specifically, and how have you guys kind of evolved together here in the back half?
I think, like I always tell people, like, you know, he's a new guy, new to the team. I think for the most, kind of the first part of the season, he was trying to figure out his way, and he was very quiet. You know, he didn't want to, you could tell that he was timid. He didn't want to step on a lot of toes, you know, coming from Oklahoma City, and stuff like that. But I think, like I always tell people, that the more me and him connected off the court, it kind of helped on the court. Like I said, like, I met his mom, I met his family, he's met my brother. So, like, you know, the more that we've connected off the court, the better it's been on the court. And, like, the play that he's been playing with is phenomenal. I always tell him, like, for me personally, I think at some point in his career, he could definitely, like, lead the league in assists. And his IQ, his ability to pass the ball, I always tell him, like, he could get a triple-double every night. So he just does a lot of different stuff that impacts the game in terms of not only scoring, but, like, assists, rebounding, altering shots. Him being a legit, like, 6'8", can guard multiple positions on the court. So, you know, he helps our team out a lot in many different ways. And, you know, he's playing with a tremendous confidence right now. And, like I said, like, it's been awesome to see his growth over this year. And you got to love those type of stories that, you know, a lot of people count you out and then you prove them wrong. So for me, that's been the best part.
Also, what's your favorite moment of the season and why is it you dunking all over Victor Wembanyama?
Yes! Yes!
I wouldn't even say that's my – I think that was a good moment for me, but I think my favorite moment probably right now got to be that Lakers game. Got to be that Lakers game. Because I think, like, I after the game, I sat back and I realized that each and every one of us that was on that court played a part and hit a big shot. Like, Vooch hit a big three, then Kev hit a big three, then Pat hit a big three, then I hit a big three, then obviously Josh hit the half-court shot. So I think that was – and then, like, it's just always fun. Like, you know, even though – you know how games go, like – people think it's over, so you see people walking to the exits, they're leaving.
Uh-huh.
So we're looking in the crowd, people are leaving, and then, like, for us to, like, flip the script and each and every one of us have a big moment in that situation was dope for me. And I think that was my favorite part, just because everybody played a role in it.
Have you ever been part of something like that, like an ending like that?
No. No, I think I always tell people the closest thing was my rookie year in Charlotte when Zach hit 13 threes. That game was... that game was crazy, but like this game was nuts. Like, I don't think, I think, like I said, the win probability was like 99.2% that we would lose the game. So for me, that was probably the craziest game I've ever been a part of.
You look like you blacked out on the dunk. That's why I asked it. That's why I asked it the way I did.
Oh, I did black out. Oh no, I definitely blacked out. Because after the game, I think I was talking to Pat, and I was like, man, like, I'm looking at their video afterwards, and I'm yelling and stuff, and I'm like, I feel like I just got out of character, man. I ain't really like that. But
it's okay. We're okay with it. Everybody loved it.
I know we don't have much time left, but your rival is in the Final Four. Who are you rooting for? Do you have any interest?
Yeah, like I love basketball, so I've been keeping up with it, obviously. I'd be lying if I didn't fill out my bracket and say I didn't have Duke winning in one of them.
Wow. Okay.
I had Duke winning
shocked.
In one of them, and I had Florida winning in the other one. So I'd be lying if I didn't have Duke winning one of my brackets, for sure.
So it's you versus Billy is essentially what is happening here.
Yeah, Coach and then Trey. Don't forget about Trey because he talks so much about Duke basketball.
Oh my goodness. I can only imagine what those conversations are like.
Yeah, he was on the phone. We was in the training room the other day, and me and Trey was in the training room because obviously he's rehabbing his foot right now, and I was getting treatment. And he turns the phone, and it's John Shire on the phone, and he's like, Kobe said, what up? And, like, John, like, obviously we're chopping up a little bit. I tell him congratulations, but it was just – he just, like, has a way of throwing stuff in your face. You know what I'm saying?
As most of us do when our teams are doing really well and someone else's team is doing very poorly. I get it.
Kobe, this has been so much fun. We can't say thanks enough for you joining us. And I know you got to get to D-Rose, so tell D-Rose we said thank you for letting us take the time with you.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Uncertainty. Self-doubt. Stressing about not knowing where to start. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Word art. Sorry, live, laugh, lovers. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
Hey, it's me, Paige DeSorbo, and I'm so excited to share my new shoe collection at DSW, filled with my favorite styles and trends for spring. Because if you know me, you know I'm kind of obsessed with shoes. And by kind of obsessed, I mean head over heels. You're going to love these shoes. So snag super cute styles like cute flats, fun heels, and cool sneakers from the Paige DeSorbo collection right now at your DSW store or DSW.com.
I've been working with a Nourish dietitian for the last 6 months, and it's been life-changing. I've lost weight, healed my relationship with food, and have way more energy. Working with a dietitian online to create a personalized nutrition plan was so easy thanks to Nourish. The best part? I pay $0 out of pocket because Nourish accepts hundreds of insurance plans. 94% of patients pay $0 out of pocket. Find your dietitian at usenourish.com. That's usenourish.com.
It's no surprise that facial hair is personal. It grows from your face. Whether you're going smooth shaven or maintaining a beard, Dollar Shave Club offers shave and grooming products that are always high quality, but never overpriced. Visit DollarShaveClub.com and use promo code SHAVEUP for 20% off $20 or more.
Street Easy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let Street Easy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
And I made a comment, and in no way was I intending to take a jab or a slight at Pitching Ninja, which is a great resource for people who can break down the art of pitching. So I went back, I watched the broadcast last night, and clearly it was not what I intended to say, and I apologized. I reached out to Rob privately, and he's the guy who runs Pitching Ninja, and we had a great conversation. He said, I understand. Yeah, there's no bad beef here or anything like that. I know what I intended to say was, because I'm not on Twitter anymore, Twitter and X is not a source for me. And I said that on the previous game broadcast that I deleted it and I'm not on Twitter anymore. So just wanted to clarify that. I am a big fan of Pitching Ninja. I think it's great for the game of baseball.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. That is the voice of John Schifrin, and the White Sox play-by-play guy had kind of bad-mouthed Pitching Ninja, and then you saw the great Brian Bannister respond to that, and we're delighted to bring in Rob Friedman. He, of course, is the Pitching Ninja. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out. It's on Twitter. You can find it on all sorts of different social media, and Rob does a great job. I love, Rob, when you break down so you can see a guy throwing two pitches that go to different areas, the way that people can disguise
that.
Fascinating stuff. Really well done, and welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, I got to tell you, you must have been confused when you were first kind of
drawn into
criticized.
This.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm just sitting there watching a game, chilling out, and all of a sudden I hear my name, and I'm like, what? Why am I catching strays here? Like, I didn't understand it. So it was just really weird.
It was very strange and unexpected. But I think it's interesting from one standpoint, too, Rob, to look at after John Schifrin said what he said, almost immediately, within 10 minutes, Brian Bannister went to X as well. And I think it was reminded people just how many people rely on what you do. Brian Bannister, the head of pitching, director of pitching for the Chicago White Sox, very highly regarded and widely respected in the game. And he said that you are one of the best things to ever happen to baseball. What would make him say that? How surprised and how happy were you to see that expressed?
I was really, because I have a lot of respect for him. I think he's brilliant at what he does. And it's always good to hear that. And he's always been a really big supporter too. Like I'm a big Danny fan. He's a good dude. And I mean, I was surprised. Like, you know, I didn't even want this whole thing to be anything. Mm-hmm. It just came out of the blue, and I'm just a poor little dude sitting at my computer and getting shot at. But apparently it wasn't even a shot. I get what he was trying to say. And it was big enough to, I mean, he contacted me on Instagram, apologized, and then said it on air, which he didn't have to do. So, my hat's off.
Well, we're talking to Rob Friedman here on the Score Hotline. Aturo, you're Aturo Hometown Tire. Check him out at aturo.com. And, you know, I think that what was interesting was the report was from Brooke Fletcher, who said that a lot of the young pitchers love watching that tape, love looking at what pitchers are doing and how they can do the same thing and kind of feed the same pitch in a similar fashion, only, one pitch is going one way and one is going the other. It is fascinating to look at, and I'm sure it is helpful for a lot of guys as they try to duplicate pitching as well as some of the clips you show.
Yeah, you nailed it, because I think a lot of these guys, you know, they don't have time to look at a bunch of other pitchers in the league. They're out there trying to perfect their stuff, but they kind of like to see what's going on. So I'm able to kind of give them a taste of the highlights of what's going on in the league and who's nasty, and also try to get behind each pitch and figure out how to throw it so that these guys can learn from each other. I mean, I've had Carrick Skubal take notes on Clayton Kershaw's slider. We've had a whole Paul Skeens learn from the overlays that I do to, he said, like, yeah, now I see how I can throw my fastball and sweeper in the same tunnel. And even if it's a miss, I can get a K on it by tunneling a sweeper off the fastball that missed. So it's fun to hear that from people. And, you know, I love what I do every day. It's so much fun.
And it can be found at Pitching Ninja on X, and I think you'll go see what we're talking about if people aren't that aware. So using your level of expertise, which Brian Bannister complimented as being so good for baseball, Rob, how would you evaluate the young starting pitching rotation, with the exception of Martin Perez, that the White Sox trotted out there for the first five games. They didn't give up an earned run until Shane Smith's first start in the fifth spot in the rotation. This is what the White Sox are leaning on in terms of hope this season. What do you think of their young pitchers?
Yeah, I mean, this may sound silly, but they look really, really good, and I think that they are really, really good. Bannister's done a great job in looking at, you know, how to make – he's really big in seam-shifted wake and other stuff like that, and guys like Davis Martin and Shane Smith are taking advantage of it with their change-ups. They have they're throwing kick changes, which is kind of the new thing. So all these guys are paying attention to the new things that are going on in the sport and tailoring their arsenals accordingly, and it's really paying off. Like, I'm excited to watch White Sox games.
It was amazing to see how quickly you had Shane Smith up and on your site. It was extraordinary because he's just some young guy who's coming out, but he's throwing – He's mixing it up, and the overlays are by far the greatest tool you have because you see exactly where the ball is going, and it looks like the same arm slot, and that's why it's so good, and I think it helps younger pitchers looking at it. But it's also, you know, that guy was like in his first outing, and, you know, he's already up on Pitching Ninja. I think everybody was kind of fired up.
I mean, I was fired up to see that pitch because it won my second filthiest pitch of the day that day, too. So it was his first strikeout. It was a ridiculous changeup. And I don't even know the last guy that his first strikeout was going to be, like, potentially the filthiest pitch one of the filthiest changeups you'll ever see. Like, it was crazy.
So what will you do today? How do you approach each day of the baseball season looking for the filthiest pitch of the day and looking for guys who may stand out to you, like a Shane Smith, or maybe it's Hunter Green, or whoever you choose to break down in any given day?
Well, today, unfortunately, there's only a few games. So fortunately, it's easy for me to watch, like, every pitch. I watch a lot of baseball. My son came in yesterday. He's like, how do you even pay attention? I had like nine games up at one point. So I watch a lot of baseball and search out for, like, my real opinion. Not, you know, I look at some of the stats behind the pitch, but it's really, like, visually what jumps out at me, and then backfilling it with the stats behind it, because I think people get blinded. If you throw too many numbers at it, baseball becomes a math sport. Some people love it, but I think some people also just want to see the fun of the game and the wickedness of the pitches. So I watch it all, and I make an honest assessment. I have no biases when I do it other than wanting to see the filthiest stuff I can see.
So we know you're a lawyer, and you've been doing this for a while. Do you consider yourself a baseball analyst above all else, or are you a social media personality? Those are kind of your double roles.
Dude, I have no idea. Like, I don't even know how I got into doing this. I was a lawyer. I started my own internet company, an internet software company that has nothing to do with baseball. And then just started doing this as a hobby because I was coaching, and it just took off. And now I guess I consider myself a baseball analyst, social media guy, or just the luckiest person on earth, because I have no idea how this happened.
Well, as you seek the filthiest pitch yesterday, Garrett Crochet was among those that you found. Is there any pitcher in baseball with any filthier stuff than Crochet?
You know, he is absolutely way, way up there. I mean, Paul Skene's pitch for pitch is pretty nasty. But, I mean, Crochet is as good as anybody right now. Dude shoves, and I think was, you know, everybody's waiting for him to break out, and boy, he's an absolute legitimate ace.
What, you know, I understand that this kind of just happened for you, but you must have been, I know you have a background, you've done some coaching, but you must have been, you know, really passionate about all the baseball you were watching before this happened. And by the way, we should let people know, they can go to your website. You have great gear. I love the baseball wrapped up in the ninja. That is is super cool looking. It makes a hell of a t-shirt. But how easily did this flow for you? Did it take off right away? How do you explain the phenomena that the Pitching Ninja has become?
Yeah, that's a great question, because like I started out, coaching. So I got drafted into coaching, and I was like, look, I wasn't some great player. I just wanted to learn as much as I could. So I came up in baseball and social media on like internet message boards back when Kyle Bodie at Driveline started out, and Ben Brewster at Tread Athletics, and you know, a bunch of these guys, and Eric Cressy. All of us started out together on the same baseball message board, and we all went our different ways, but we all learned from each other. And I just shared the stuff that I learned and then started digging deep, because I'm a lawyer and I ask a lot of questions and I try to sort out the BS from the truth. So I was just digging, and I just started posting stuff on Twitter, you know, after a while. And then I found like major leaguers are following me. I'm like, holy cow, what's going on? And it just kept going more and more. And then I started getting DMs from them, asking them to help them with some pitch grips or asking them how this looked. And then, you know, people are, they're constantly now like learning from my page, which is not what I expected when I started this like 11 years ago. But, you know, and it'll never get, I hope it never gets old, because I consider this amazing to me.
You've had such great interactions with so many major leaguers. You've written a book about Yu Darvish and Yamamoto and Ohtani, and you have a lot of different experiences. But is there any one or two interactions that stand out as being most memorable or meaningful to you?
Yeah, probably my favorite is I was having dinner with my wife at a restaurant like in our neighborhood. And she's like, why are you on your phone all dinner? I'm like, Yu Darvish DM'd me because he wanted to get a grip from Shane Bieber. And I was like, I can't leave Yu Darvish hanging. he ended up taking the pitch and throwing it his next outing and like struck out 12. Was like, what am I going to do? Yu Darvish wants something. I am dropping everything.
You know, what's extraordinary, when he was here with the Cubs, like we would lose count of how many pitches a guy could throw.
Almost double digits.
It was ridiculous. Yeah. Is he the most prolific thrower of different pitches?
Yeah, he's brilliant. Like, that dude is a pitch grip savant. I was interviewing Michael King, and Michael King told me, like, Yu Darvish just randomly threw this wicked sweeper, and King, like, they didn't want to bother him, but he comes up to him and says, hey, what was that? And he said, I call that my King sweeper, because he copied Michael King's sweeper in the middle of the game for no reason other than he wanted to. So he's brilliant. Like, I love that dude.
He's creative, yeah. And Cubs fans remember just how brilliant he was before they dumped him to the Padres. When you look at the current Cubs staff and rotation with Shota Imanaga, I think Ben Brown's really interesting. He's into a lot of these things that we're talking about in terms of trying different things and looking at the analytics of them all. What do you think of the Cubs rotation, and does anybody stand out to you?
Well, I love Shota Imanaga. Is just, not only is he nasty, but he's one of my favorite guys, and I think Chicago's favorite guys to watch pitch, because he always has some quirky expression. He's a hilarious dude. He just gets it. Like, he is a guy that you will drop everything to watch. I agree with you. Ben Brown is he's a work in progress, but he will shove. I got to talk to him in Tokyo. Really good dude. That knuckle curve is an absolute hammer. And I expect big things out of him. And then Steele is obviously a top tier pitcher. And, you know, he's a competitor and will continue to compete and get better.
So, Rob, I know you do a lot of work with younger players, and you offer a way for them to get out there and get seen. You're not just doing stuff with major leaguers. When do you start looking at guys? And my curiosity is because the White Sox have like a starting rotation in Birmingham that we're all waiting for in several years. Have you looked at a Noah Schultz or checked out guys on the way up?
Yeah, I do. Like, I start in college, basically, or sometimes high school. If somebody jumps out at me, usually they have to be throwing gas in high school.
Yeah.
But I definitely watch a lot of college games and, you know, try to pick who I think is going to succeed. I mean, Paul Skenes is one. Like, in college, I said, this guy's an MLB ace pitching against college kids, and it's just not fair. I thought Chase Burns was outstanding and a guy that you could just plug into a rotation. Hagen Smith, same way. Hagen Smith is going to be a star.
Good to know.
So you were in Tokyo. Obviously, you were there for Cubs-Dodgers, I'm imagining, and you have a really good knowledge base of what Ohtani has to offer. But when he's not hitting walk-offs and when the Dodgers aren't starting 8-0, there are plans for him to return to the mound, which is exciting. What do you think of that? And when people – have we forgotten how good of a pitcher he possibly can be just because he's been out since the surgery?
You took the words right out of my mouth because I'm sitting there going – what are you guys talking about? Like, let him hit only. He is one of the filthiest pitchers in Major League Baseball, a Cy Young contender every time he spends a full season on the bump. Could win the pitching triple crown any year that he's out there. And, you know, did you forget that the sweeper he threw against Mike Trout, or the fact he hits 101 and has a splitter that just dives and just changes his pitch? He's another guy who tinkers constantly and is the ultimate competitor on the mound. You can see it in his face. Like, when he's got runners on, dude takes it up an entire level. He's Superman. Like, you want him on the mound. I don't understand the idea that oh, no, he should just focus on his offense. Like, this is who he is. He was always coming up a better pitcher than a hitter. Now he's great at both.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much fun because there are some guys where you just know right away that their talent level is just off the charts and they're going to be great pitchers. And then there's other guys that just sort of learn how to pitch, you know? I mean, you know, we were blessed to have Greg Maddux here in Chicago for all those years, and you would watch that guy. He's just one of the most amazing pitchers that I've ever seen. I remember watching some video of him setting up a pitch at the end of the season to someone so that he could strike him out when the playoffs came. You know, he just was the ultimate thinking man's pitcher.
And I got to interview him, which is one of the highlights of all this stuff I do. He's a guy that I model a lot of what I do after him, like watching him pitch all those years. I'm in Atlanta, so I got to watch him pitch here. And he is, I mean, one of the smartest pitchers ever to step foot on a mound. Outthinks people, makes he's filthy. He's a dude that I wish there were more guys like him, but the other thing is I don't know that there can be.
Like, right.
His talent was way off the charts in a different way. He didn't throw gas, but his brain and ability to move and locate pitches is ridiculous.
Well, before you were improving the game, I'm sure you were a fan of the game. So who are your favorite players of all time, and who did you grow up rooting for?
I mean, I grew up watching Tom Seaver, was a guy that I consider a pitching artist. Greg Maddux, Pedro. I mean, it's between those two is like what I consider the best pitchers of all time. Maybe throw the big unit in there as well. But those are the guys that I really, really love watching.
Well, Rob, thanks a ton. It's great catching up with you. We love you in Chicago.
We do.
Don't let anyone tell you different.
We do love you in Chicago. We love North Carolina graduates in Chicago.
That's
you got
right.
Jordan,
That's
Ben
right.
Johnson,
yeah,
and the pitching ninja.
I'm kind of the Michael Jordan of pitching social media. There you go.
Yeah, that's great stuff.
You're the best. Great stuff, Rob. Thanks.
Good talking with y'all.
That is Rob Friedman. He is the pitching ninja. I want to get one of those t-shirts. I love that.
He's got great gear.
Oh, the gear is
excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
He has fun with it. He clearly loves what he does.
He loves baseball.
He's committed to it, watching it 9 games at once. Goodness sakes.
Yeah,
he's going to be very disappointed today. There's a light schedule. So.
Yeah, yeah. What will he do with himself? Watch some Birmingham baseball.
Well, he said Hagen Smith's going to be a star.
He did say that.
So we're going to go back to that probably several times this year. The pitching ninja says Hagen Smith going to be a star.
It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Some people follow the rules, but where's the fun in that? I'm Soraya, and this is Rule Breakers, the podcast where we celebrate the rebels, the risk takers, and the ones who make their own way. Every week, I sit down with the boldest voices in sports, entertainment, and beyond to talk about breaking barriers, defying expectations, and rewriting the rules. No limits, no apologies, just real talk. Follow and listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This hour is brought to you by Jewel Osco.
The Score Midday Show, 10 to 2 on 670 The Score.
This really opens the whole board for us. So we're going to be able to sit back and kind of look and say, what's the best thing to do for the Chicago Bears? And who's the best player that can impact? So we got some tough decisions and a lot of film to watch between now and the draft.
That was Ryan Poles after he introduced the players he traded for and also free agents. He did say in one of his podcasts that came out a couple days ago, or maybe yesterday, that free agency is basically over, was how he put it. So they've moved on to the draft portion of the program. And for that, we go to the Circa Sports Illinois hotline. Download the Circa app today. That is where our friend, Bears reporter for The Score, Chris Emma, joins us. And Chris, you went kind of viral over the week because you got some really good nuggets, I would say, when it comes to how you found out that the Bears' spot at 10 in the draft might not be what we think it is.
Yeah, Layla Marshall, good to be with you. Yeah, I you know, poking around the league as I often try to do and see what's happening up at Halas Hall, what they're looking at. And I kind of got some insights into the idea that the Bears are indeed drawn perhaps to the idea of moving up in the top 10. And these are all scenarios. I'd preface everything by saying these are all just scenarios and considerations at this point, but it makes sense. And here's why it makes sense. And I wrote about it on 670thescore.com. You can check out the full column if you want to catch it all later. But the premise of this idea is that this is not going to cost a significant haul to move up. This is not a considerably strong draft. And because of that, the cost of doing business is not what it usually is. So if the Bears want to move up, say, call it the fourth spot, the New England Patriots are sitting there at four, you're not going to have to give up a significant haul. You're talking about potentially dealing just one of your 2 second-round picks and making the move from 10 to 4. That puts you in a position to guarantee you're getting one of your blue-chip guys, where, frankly, the 10 spot's not a great spot in which to be with this draft. So it's something they're certainly considering. I think all teams are kind of looking at the board right now and saying, how can we jump up and make that move? And there's a lot of factors and plays and variables that will play out here in the next 3 weeks up until draft night. But away we go. It's going to be really interesting.
I did appreciate you talking about just how the NFL is valuing picks in this draft. We talk about it a lot in the NBA. You know, Marshall and I were discussing the benefits of a simple pick swap when it came to the Rockets and the Suns a couple of years ago. That's reaping benefits for both teams. We don't do that enough in the NFL and in football, I don't think. You also mentioned a trade up two spots to the number 8 overall pick currently held by the Panthers would cost the Bears their 3rd-round pick and net Carolina's 5th-round selection, according to the trade chart. So that echoes a little bit of what you're saying, how the value of the picks is different based on what the Bears' assets are.
You're right. Yeah. And the reason why is because of how NIL has reshaped the way that the NFL draft plays out. Players who would normally declare for the draft 10 years ago are much more incentivized now than they were before to stick around in the college game. A lot of them are making more money being a college star than they would be a 5th-round pick in the NFL. And the value now is sticking around in the college game. So there's fewer underclassmen declaring, which means the bottom of the draft is not as exciting as it used to be. There's not a ton of value. A lot of these trade charts now that were built 10 years ago are a little irrelevant at this point because the value of those day 3 picks are simply not what they used to be. So there's a reason why teams are looking at the day 3 of the draft a lot differently than they were before. And also the top of this draft isn't great either. This is a starter's draft is what a lot of the experts are calling it. Guys like Daniel Jeremiah, whose opinion I respect so highly, he said that there's only a couple, you know, transcendent superstar level prospects. You're talking about Abdul Carter, obviously, Travis Hunter, potentially Mason Graham's guy I'm very high on, Ashton Jeanty. There's not a lot of those guys who are saying this is a guy who's going to reshape our franchise. And if you're sitting there where the Bears are right now with the 10th pick, you're saying, give us the best player available. That might not be the most exciting player. That might be not be somebody you're really thrilled about getting inside Halas Hall. So, yeah, if you want to make that move, Carolina is an interesting spot because they seem to have their quarterback in Bryce Young now. He really stepped it up late last season. And because of that, they might be willing to make that move. That might be a spot in which the Bears can jump up and solidify somebody who might not be there for pick 10. That is one scenario. Yeah. So the third round pick makes sense. You can make that move with the fifth coming back or day three swap, whatever it is, to equal things out on the trade chart. But yeah, there's a lot of ways the Bears can maximize their value with a top 10 pick.
Chris, it's interesting because last year we all remember how the dream scenario in some people's minds was to have a quarterback and receiver in Rome Odunze both taken in the top 10. And it worked out perfectly for the Bears. But with the lack of star quarterback power or the need of quarterback for some of these teams, it seems like this is one of the all-timers as far as a draft where you're drafting as low as the Bears in the first round at 10, where you really can't predict how things are going to go because, one, we haven't seen any trades so far, but also we don't know what the teams 1 through 9, if they all keep their picks, are even going to do.
Marshall, this is the latest in more than three decades in which not a single pick has been dealt in the first round. And usually there's some kind of movement by now. If not from the previous season with some kind of deadline swap, then at this point there's some kind of movement. There's not been a single team trading out from the first round. And it kind of reflects what you're saying there, is that there's not that run on quarterbacks yet. There's two, maybe three guys who are going to go high when you're talking about the quarterback position. If you're a Bears fan, root for Jackson Dart to be up there. Like, start hyping up Jackson Dart as the second coming of whatever, because you'd love to have that trickle down. Adam Schefter of ESPN was talking a couple days ago saying that he thinks Cleveland and New York, the Giants, could be looking at position players, not quarterbacks. That'd be Abdul Carter, that'd be Travis Hunter, if indeed Cam Ward is going number one overall. So now the trickle down to the Bears is that could set up the Patriots, who do have their quarterback in Drake May, to be more motivated to move down. So the scenario I'm setting up now of potentially making this trade, it could go one of two ways. One is you could have a deal done anytime in the next 3 weeks leading up to night one up in Green Bay. And you make that move up to 4 with the Patriots. Maybe it's 8 with the Panthers, wherever it may be. You have that deal done and you're jumping the line. You don't necessarily have to say we're getting this guy because we're here. You're just saying our cloud is now 3 or 4 guys and we feel really great about those guys being blue chip players. Or you could just set up the framework of these deals ahead of time. And maybe it's you got a handshake in place with the Patriots for when they go on the clock. And if, you know, Hunter and Carter are gone and they're ready to trade down, then you got that deal in place and you have that agreement set. And suddenly the Bears jump up to the clock. Maybe it's the Jaguars at pick 5 right there as well. They got Trevor Lawrence in place. So I think there's going to be a lot of teams that are motivated at some point in time to move down from the top 5 or the top 8. And if the Bears want to make that move up, it's not going to cost them a significant deal.
I also think it's valid, though, to point out that I don't know that the Bears, even in trading up for somebody and losing one of their picks in this draft, is a good idea at all. Like, you can make the argument that based on what they still need as a team, especially with the 4 picks in the top 72, that I want to keep all of those for that reason that you mentioned, Chris. At least you get a more accurate understanding of what you can expect.
I'm with you. I usually would not advocate for this kind of stuff. I'm a believer in having as much, the trade down scenarios and building up your stockpile of the draft capital and seeing what you can do with it. And it's unfortunate because the Bears have not drafted well in the mid to late rounds. Ryan Poles does not have a strong track record where you can hang your hat on it and say, we're going to get some really good guys here on day 2 and day 3 who are going to be starters down the road or whatever it may be. That's not a reason to give up your day 2 picks. You shouldn't say, well, I'm not good at drafting, so I'm going to trade these picks away. But the reality is that it's not a super strong draft. There's less or there's more variability and less assurity in those spots. So I think that's part of the motivation. And frankly, the Bears feel like they're in a really good spot now moving forward where you can get somebody in the top 10 who's going to be an impact player for many years to come. And there's a lot of different ways you can look at it. Like, my guy, if they're making that move up to the pick 4, my guy's Mason Graham. I've been beating the drum for Mason Graham out of Michigan for a while. I think he has the highest floor in this draft of anybody out there. I think he's a 10-year type starter on the defensive line. And he's somebody where you make that pick, you feel really good about it. He's your guy for the long term and really a disruptive presence for that defensive front. But there's a lot of different ways you can look at it, too. Maybe it is the Tyler Ward. Our buddy Mark Grody has been talking about Tyler Ward. I think he's been advocating for that pick. Like, makes a lot of sense. The Ashton Jeanty thing is certainly out there. And I think there is real consideration to that at this point. It's a curious move because What it tells me is that the Bears are ready to win now, that they feel like they've got everything in place to be an NFC North contender, to be a legitimate championship contender if they make that move. It's not the long-term play, and it certainly is putting a lot on the arms of your second-year quarterback, but it would tell me that the Bears feel really confident about where they stand.
Chris Emma, our Score Bears reporter, on with us to talk all things draft and the possibility that the Bears might even trade up in this draft, knowing they've got four of the top 72 picks. Chris, let's go back to what you talked about with the NIL affecting the quality of the later round picks, because this has been a thing, but it seems like it's becoming a bigger thing. Is this something that's going to cause teams to operate differently when you talk about how they view those back half draft picks in the future and maybe as early as this draft? I'm wondering how that changes the entire landscape of how you build a team, because many teams depend on their development of players who are drafted, let's say, after the third round, as why they can get the most out of them, especially teams who go to the playoffs every year, right? That's where they get a lot of guys, because they don't get a lot of top 15, top 20 picks.
You're right. Yeah. And to the Bears' credit, they've been out in front of this trend. Like, they've recognized and forecasted the talent in day three of the draft and said, we're better off trading for Ryan Bates or Jonah Jackson or Joe Tooney than we are sitting here and seeing what we can get with these picks. And Ryan Poles has been very aggressive dealing day three picks to get veteran guys who he sees as plug-and-play talents. And I give the Bears credit for that. They were out in front of this, I think, a lot more than some of these other teams were in terms of assessing the value of those picks as being lesser than they were before. And sure, you can go back to the 22 or 23 draft and find some guys who were day three standouts and superstar level pickups and say, man, the Bears really whiffed on this guy. But there's so few of those guys at this point now. It's a different value system because of the way that NIL has played out. It's impacted everything, certainly the college game, but obviously the trickle to effect to the NFL as well. And so if you're a college player and you're getting fifth round grades or sixth round grades, and there's even the chance you go undrafted versus the chance of sticking around with a power program and getting million plus an NIL deal to stick around for one more year, why wouldn't you take that? Forgive me, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I've written about it before. Like every year, there's fewer and fewer underclassmen declaring for the NFL draft than there were in years past. And that trend is going to stay that way until there's some kind of NIL regulation. But that certainly doesn't seem like it's coming anytime soon.
Well, I also think it just makes things more accurate. We live in a capitalist society. Money is how we measure people's value in the NFL. So it would make sense that the money that is being spent on certain players based on the values to their team would give you a little bit more accurate assumption of how some of these people are actually valued. Like that makes all the sense in the world. I don't necessarily mind that the draft is now less unpredictable. I also think it keeps a lot of GMs, Chris, from being the guy who thinks that he can reinvent the wheel. And I think there's a lot of those in the league.
Yeah, we've certainly seen a few of them in Chicago. I mean, it's just, yeah, you're exactly right. And I think it challenges teams now to evolve with the draft. And so when we're setting up these scenarios of trading like, this is a way of trying to evolve with this trend. I give Ryan Poles and his brass a ton of credit for trying to be out in front of this. And this Bears front office is trying to be cutting edge in more ways than just this. I mean, we know about the approach to analytics. We heard Ben Johnson citing the analytics he wants to value. Like it's refreshing to see the Bears being on the cutting edge, because that's just not something that's been the case for year after year. They value ways of how can we be better than other teams? How can we take advantage of this trend or that trend? And it's good to see. There's some smart people up there at Hallis Hall, and I know things haven't worked out the last couple of years under Poles' watch. This is a proven year, and it's such a huge part of his job is going to be hitting on these draft picks, because as you continue to invest in this roster through free agency and try to patch holes and ways and you messed up in the draft, you got to hit with these mid and late round picks as well. Joe Tooney's a great pickup, but he's also on the wrong side of 30. You don't know how long you're going to have with him. Jonah Jackson was a great pickup as well. Started right away for you this year. You don't know if he's going to be great. You don't know what you're getting in him yet. So when you talk about investing, and in particular here with the offensive line, you've got to be able to make sure you're assessing and getting quality depth in there, not just through the draft, but through the waiver wires, through any means possible to make this roster deeper, younger, and more talented. So you're able to graduate from a Joe Tooney to a young player coming up and stepping in that guard position.
All right, Chris. So you mentioned that the numbers were down. So I looked it up because I wanted to be able to tell everyone. So basically 70 undergraduate guys in the draft this year. Now, that's more than last year when it was 60, but it peaked back in 2018. It was 106, and then it went down to 99 in 2019. So it's definitely dwindling from what we saw about 5 or 6 years ago with all the NIL money and everything going forward. My question is this: how much pressure now is on Ryan Poles for this draft specifically? He does not have a good track record overall when it comes to the draft. Now, he's made some deals which allowed them to get the number one overall pick, in which they selected Caleb Williams. Obviously, Rome Odunze is a guy who could end up being wide receiver number one down the road. But if you look at the entirety of the draft selections, I think most people would come to the conclusion that he has not been above average, and some would say even a poor drafter overall. So how much pressure is there on Ryan Poles, knowing not how long his contract is up to get it done this year and do it right?
Yeah, there's a ton of pressure. Look, Kansas City has been a modern NFL dynasty in large part because of Patrick Mahomes, obviously. But you look at the way that they've been able to assess that roster, keep turning things over year after year. It's because of the way that they've been able to address and land needs in the later rounds. They've been so good at evaluating talent and building a deep roster where you're able to train off of Joe Tooney because you got somebody ready to step in there. The Bears have not done that yet. They've not hit on those picks. If you want to look at Ryan Poles' draft resume to this point, there's not something where you say, man, that's like pound for pound a great pick. Like maybe Braxton Jones in the fifth round is a starter. Maybe that's the pick you hang your hat on. Kyler Gordon, his first ever draft pick coming in the second round, good pickup. But like there's not a long list of guys where you say Ryan Poles' draft success stories. He needs to have a great draft. He needs to really hit on some of these picks. And not just saying like day one starters this year. I'm talking about developmental guys. I'm talking about guys who are starters next year, the year after that. Like they've just not done anything in these first three drafts where this is the rebuilding period now. In theory, it's done. You hope you're done rebuilding at this point. There's not a ton of, you know, this great influx of young talent coming through the draft. And it's why you have to go trade for Joe Tooney and Jonah Jackson and make all these aggressive moves in free agency to bolster this roster. They had a great offseason, but you would like to be that team that's sitting back in March and not rushing to sign everybody because you've drafted and developed so well. So Ryan Poles seems to have a clean slate right now. He's got Ben Johnson in charge. There's a lot of hope and excitement for this thing, and obviously so much of it relies on Caleb Williams and where he can take the Bears. But as you look to the futures, you forecast 2, 3, 4 years down the road, this is a significant draft to try to strengthen the bottom of this roster and get guys who are starters in the years to come.
We love it. Chris Emma, again, the title of his column for 670 The Score, Could the Bears Trade Up in the Top 10 of the NFL Draft? Thanks for breaking it down with us.
Take care.
Thanks, Chris.
That's Chris Emma, The Score, Bears reporter. You heard him with his report that has really gained some steam over the past couple of days.
The Score Midday Show, 10 to 2 on 670 The Score.
And they're going to go into the win column. And, Bill, with that victory, they are headed to the play-in tournament. We don't know the opponent. Could be Miami. Could be Orlando. Maybe Atlanta. We don't know.
We don't know yet. But we're getting ready to go.
Ball game over. Bulls win. Bulls win. Bulls win.
That they did. The Bulls continuing to make their way somewhat up the standings.
Is that what we're calling it? Somewhat up the standings?
Yeah, you heard Chuck Swirsky. Right now, the Bulls are in that play-in spot. They clinched a play-in berth no matter what. 34-42 on the season, and that is why we are going to the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline. CircaLasVegas.com. Michael Pina, such a great basketball writer. He is now with The Ringer. And man, did he do a number on this story. Excellent stuff from Michael. The story is called The Chicago Bulls and the Double-Edged Sword of Success. An excellent way of putting it. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Michael, we're excited to talk to you because you're echoing a lot of the sentiments that have been floating around this city for more than just this season. Mm-hmm. And we thought, because the trade of Zach LaVine happened, and the, I guess, attempted trade of Nikola Vucevic, that the Bulls were going firmly in one direction, only to find out that that's not necessarily the case. They believe they can grow with these young players and make a push for the playoffs while also getting their draft pick back and having a shot at the lottery. But of course, if you make the playoffs, you're not in the lottery. And now we're kind of left looking around like, okay, so what's next? But in the midst of that, the play of Coby White, the reigning Eastern Conference Player of the Month, the development of Buzelis, struggling with that one right there. It's shown us that maybe the Bulls have some of these pieces that Arturis Karnišovas was talking about when he said 9 to 10 players to win a championship.
Yeah, it's just this fascinating dichotomy, right? So to your point, I think I, along with every Bulls fan or most Bulls fans, assumed that when they traded Zach LaVine right before the trade deadline, that they were going to finally pivot into a teardown. And that is clearly not what has taken place. And so from there, it's like, it's really cool to be excited about the play of Coby White, who's been excellent and on a tear since the All-Star break, frankly, and Josh Giddey, who's averaging a 21-point triple-double since early February. And, heading into Giddey's miraculous half-court heave against the Los Angeles Lakers, they'd won eight out of their last 10 games, and they're making this push, 12-9 since the All-Star break. It's one thing to be really excited about how a team is performing in the month of March when really good teams are kind of gearing up for the playoffs and kind of looking ahead to it, and they might be resting guys or they might not be taking every single quarter and every single possession super seriously. And then there's a lot of tanking teams as well. You know, one of their wins was against the Denver Nuggets, for example, and Nikola Jokic just didn't play because that game didn't really mean a ton to the Nuggets. So there's a difference between, you know, really showing out during this stretch of the schedule and better preparing for your future by building through the draft, which is what I think that this organization should have been the priority over the last, you know, 6 weeks or so. And that has not happened. So it's just this really kind of conflicting, confusing situation that they find themselves in.
That's it. It's at what cost? At what cost is your success when you know the inevitable may be true again? You point out their lack of playoff series wins and how that hasn't happened in nearly 12 years. You talk about what it means to actually be in the play-in and who they would face. We know that it might definitely be the Cavaliers. And it leaves you wondering, you know, is this temporary somewhat happiness at the expense of something bigger later?
Yeah, because it's like, what is the best case scenario if you even get out of the play-in, which is not a guarantee? I mean, they're likely to be the 10 seed, I would say. I mean, they have a really easy schedule, so we'll see what happens. But if they're the 10 or the 9, you got to win two play-in games against, you know, Hawks, Magic, Miami Heat. Not great teams, but not atrocious teams either. So we'll see. And then if you do make the postseason, you're probably going to get waxed by the Cleveland Cavaliers, to your point. And the benefits there is you get postseason experience. You get to see kind of, I mean, we've seen Josh Giddey in the playoffs with the Oklahoma City Thunder, and it wasn't very pretty, but maybe the 3-point shooting that has been on display in the month of March will translate into a playoff series, and you can kind of go from there. And it gives you more information and more data points as you figure out how much you're going to pay this guy this summer as a restricted free agent. But no, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask what you think that pay is going to be, because it's been a topic of constant discussion here, where we started maybe $20 million a year, but I'm leaning towards the $30 million based on what you talked about, the way he's played in the second half, Josh Giddey.
Yeah, it is a fascinating one. Look, like, if you look at the comps for players in his draft class and what they've made who are in a similar statistical profile with Giddey and just kind of his winning impact and skill set, you have Jalen Suggs, 5 years, $150 million, same contract for Jalen Johnson. I would think that is what his representatives are kind of aiming for. But at the same time, he doesn't really have the market. And if you're the Bulls and he's restricted, I'd say go out and get that much money before we pay it to you. So we'll see kind of how that goes. But yeah, I think just going back to my original point, you know, the upside of making the postseason has its benefits with you know, getting experience in that environment for not just Giddy, but Coby White, who's been excellent, as I said, and Matis Buzelis, who I think that is the kind of golden coin or whatever that you want to say about this team. Like, that's the player I'm most excited about, and I think the Chicago Bulls and their fans should be most excited about going forward. I think he's been excellent over the past month, 2 months, and really projects with his skill set, his size, his length, to be one of the better two-way players coming out of this draft class, and we'll see kind of what that means in terms of an all-star trajectory. But, like, if you look around the league, teams who are in this type of place are losing intentionally for a reason. It's like, this is a great draft by everyone who studies college basketball, high school basketball, says. And you have the Philadelphia 76ers, the Toronto Raptors, the Charlotte Hornets, the Washington Wizards. All these teams are tanking for a reason, because they want to build through the draft. They see that there are organizations that are ahead of them and will be ahead of them for the next few years on the horizon. Your Clevelands, your Bostons, your Knicks, your Pacers, even the Pistons are rising with a young core. And if you're Chicago, it's like, how are you going to top those teams that I just mentioned while the teams below you are rising? And that's why you tank. That's why you tank, because you want to get a Cooper Flag or any of the other potential blue chip prospects in this draft class. And then you have a young core and you can kind of go from there. But that's not the path that Karnisovas has taken. And so we'll see where that leads over the next few years.
I'm glad you brought up the Sixers, because Marshall and I monitor them all the time. Nobody knows how to do a process like them, of course. But when you consider their draft pick is top six protected, today Tyrese Maxey expected to be ruled out for the rest of the season. You know what the objective is.
Right. You know what the direction is clear for that organization. It's easy to follow. It's easy to understand what they want to do. And they're committed to it. And they're smart for doing that, frankly. Like, there's really no, it doesn't really make sense as an organization to win these games right now. Particularly if, like, unless you think that Josh Giddey is going to be this perennial all-star, and Coby White, who I think has been really good, is going to continue to ascend. And over the last 20 or so games, you know, averaging 25 points a game efficiently, if that is for real and you think that, then building off them as a foundation for your backcourt that you really want to invest in makes sense. I think it's reasonable to be a little skeptical of that, though, when you compare these teams to when you compare this roster as a whole to some of the teams that I listed before, and just kind of where they're headed, how deep they are, how talented they are, and the fact that they already have all-star, proven all-star foundational pieces that they're building around.
Can you not see a world in which either Coby White or Josh Giddey become an all-star just if the Bulls have a winning record, let's say next season at the time of the all-star break? Because I feel like if Coby White does what he's done since the all-star break next season, with obviously no Zach LaVine to start the season, now he probably won't have Nikola Vucevic, but somebody will be there. It feels like he'll shoulder the load. And the most impressive thing about him since the all-star break is just the level of efficiency as he's changed his style of play.
I think it's possible. I mean, anything's possible for sure. I think that it's really hard to make the All-Star team, right? I mean, even this season where you have someone like Tyler Hero, who averaging, you know, 24, 25 points a game, hyper efficiency on a pretty good Miami Heat team before they went in a tailspin. Great, really good offensive playmaker as well. And he only makes it really because Franz Wagner's hurt. Paolo Banchero's hurt. Joel Embiid's hurt. So it's really a lot of things kind of have to go your way to make the All-Star team. So it's not even just about being excellent on a winning team. It's about all these other factors, because there's a lot of talent in the NBA right now. So I wouldn't necessarily bet on that for someone like Coby White, or who I like, or Josh Giddey, who I also have been impressed by. And so that just kind of adds to the, I guess, the confusing part of all this, right? Where I just don't understand why they didn't tank. I guess that's as simple as that for me.
Us too, Michael. Michael Pina joining us from The Ringer. talking about the Bulls in his story about the double-edged sword of success. And that's where a lot of us sit, is knowing that we understand the end game if they did tank. I think the fans in Chicago understand that as well. We know how to tank. So I think people would be on board and still go to games because there's the promise of the future there. When you assess this all, other than what you just said, how do you feel about this plan that they are currently on right now?
I don't know what the plan is, really.
So
it's hard to analyze. I mean, actions over words is something that I believe when I'm looking at NBA teams and general managers and kind of what their strategy is with regards to team construction. And Karnisovas has said multiple times that he doesn't want to be in the middle, but his team's in the middle, and his team was in the middle last year. And that's kind of been the MO of the Chicago Bulls for quite a while now. So I don't know how long you can have the 11th or 12th or 13th overall pick or whatever it is, and not have any guaranteed blue chip, franchise altering foundational piece, where it makes sense. And so that's kind of where they are right now. And it's going to be interesting to see how they get out of it.
I think they're definitely leaning on Josh Giddey to become that piece at 22 years old. He's got more upside left in him. I just don't know if it's on the defensive end. If it's not, well, we'll see.
Michael Pina of The Ringer, we thank you so much. It's a great story, and it has a lot of graphics, too, online. I always appreciate the graphic support, so that's really cool, too. Definitely worth checking out. The Bulls and the double-edged sword of success. Love talking Bulls with you. It's great to have you on again on the Score.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you so much, guys.
Mike Florio, ProFootballTalk.com, NBC Sports, Twitter.com/ProFootballTalk.
Day by day!
Day by day!
We get better and better!
We get better and better!
We get beat, beat!
We get beat, beat!
Boom, beat, beat!
What's that? It's the game talk! It's the game talk!
NFL insider Mike Florio with Mully and Haw on 670 The Score.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Always fun to talk to the great Mike Florio, and he joins us now on the Aturo Tire Hotline. Aturo, your hometown tire, Aturo.com. Michael, good morning. How are you?
Doing great. How are you guys today?
Doing well.
We're doing well. We're curious. Watched your interview with Kevin Warren, heard everything Kevin Warren had to say. Just curious to get your opinion of him. What did you think of the well-spoken man of flowery language?
I met him years ago in Minnesota when they were opening their new practice facility. I've always been impressed by him. He's always been very kind to me. And he's got his work cut out for him. I like what they've done so far. This stadium project is not going to be an easy thing. Getting taxpayer money to subsidize these arenas is becoming more and more difficult all the time, especially as the values of NFL teams continue to skyrocket. If a measure to devote taxpayer funding to a stadium is ever on a ballot anywhere, it will fail. Can you work the back channels? Can you pull the levers of the political process independent of the ballot box to make it happen? And the leverage is limited because the Bears are never leaving Chicago. So it's down to Lakefront or Arlington Heights, and they are hoping to get the best deal they possibly can do. The question is, will they eventually take a deal, even if it's not what they want, in order to get a new stadium, or will they stay at Soldier Field indefinitely? And meanwhile, there's this desire to put the team under a roof, not just to have a facility that can host things all year long, but I think the most interesting thing Kevin Warren said to us, comparing where the Bears are going to where one of the first teams, the first team he ever worked for, was 26 years ago with the Rams, when they were the greatest show on turf. They were indoors. The team is pivoting toward offense, and the Bears have never had a high-end offense in the 50 years I've been paying attention to the NFL. They've never had the diverse and dynamic passing game and a lot of points. It's always been more defense than anything. It's one of the reasons they want to put a lid on the new stadium. We're going to see a dramatically different Bears team going forward if they can break ground and get a stadium built, or even if they can't. But it's better to have that kind of an offense in a climate-controlled environment, and that's one of the reasons why they're trying to push this project forward.
Yeah, I heard that too, Mike. I think that's a really small detail in terms of, like, big picture-wise. That's got to be far down on the list, doesn't it? There's other realistic good reasons
from a football standpoint, yeah. I think it's just interesting to hear that said out loud. I mean, we know the Bears are changing. We can see it. But the idea that you're marrying what the coaching staff and what the personnel on the field are going to be doing with the idea, let's put it under glass and get more out of it that way, I'm intrigued by the potential and how jarringly different it'll be to tune in and watch a Bears game when they're playing at home, and all of a sudden it looks like no Bears game we've ever seen before. But you're right. The biggest issue is coming up with a way to make this happen. And at some point, there's going to be a team that busts up against a wall that can't be broken down, and they're going to have to pay for their own stadium, or they're going to have to come up with some other way to pay for the stadium. And that public money 50-50, what we've seen with other projects, that 50-50 is not going to be there.
It won't be there for this one either. How much urgency did you sense from Kevin Warren? Because the last year feels like it was squandered a little bit in terms of the opportunity.
I mean, he's always very positive and upbeat, and he can turn any negative into something that is a challenge. It's a reason to get out of bed in the morning. It's what he envisions his job is, to try to solve these problems. It excites him. I don't know. Problems are problems. It's like when they say a team, it's a good problem to have. The only good problem to have is no problem. And they've got problems. They've got challenges. They've got hurdles. And the question becomes, what is the alternative to presuming you're going to get either Arlington Heights or Chicago Stadium built with 50% of the money coming from public resources? And okay, so will you do it with 25? And the other side of it too, you know, when the Jaguars did their deal recently to renovate the stadium in Jacksonville, and the local authorities, state, federal, not state and federal, but state and local, you know, they're kicking in half the money. The other owners still had to approve the deal. So, you know, it'd be one of these deals is going to go back to the owners, and they're going to say, we don't like this because it sets a bad precedent for the rest of us. We want our 50-50. If somebody's only going to get 25% taxpayer money, that's going to get used against us in future negotiations. So this I think, is a fascinating dynamic, especially because relocation is not on the table, and it'll never be on the table for a team like the Bears.
I got to tell you, Mike, I enjoyed what you wrote about the Christmas Day games, that the Chiefs have volunteered to be a permanent home team for a Christmas Day game. That reminded me so much of the issue they have now with Detroit and with Dallas, and how everybody's like, that's an unfair advantage. It's almost like they're trying to jump ahead and get the unfair advantage before it actually comes to fruition.
Yeah, and this isn't like calling shotgun on the way to the car. I mean, the Thanksgiving stuff, the justification for this permanent, indefinite Detroit-Dallas assignment is, back when no one wanted to do it, they stepped up. Now, I don't know how many years that's good for, but that's why the league continues to give the games to Detroit and Dallas, even when one or both of them aren't competitive. This time around with Christmas, everybody's going to want to play on Christmas. It's a huge audience. It's a captive audience. It's a standalone game. It's a high-profile game. Who wouldn't want to play on Christmas? Why would you give anyone a permanent commitment? Because then you're signing on for all the highs and lows and ups and downs. And what if the Chiefs stink at some point? Oh, well, we promised them this open-ended commitment to Christmas football. It just doesn't make any sense. And I think it's a matter of time before we start seeing a flex option for Christmas games.
Love it, Mike.
You know, they're already about, you know, they've shortened the time period for flexing out of Thursday. And as a fan who watches at home on Christmas Day, do I want crap games or do I want good games? So I think most fans could get behind the idea of flexing too. So that's another reason to not guarantee any one team a permanent placement on Christmas.
Thanks, Mike. Love it. Great stuff.
Thanks,
you guys.
Mike.
Yep.
That is Mike Florio. We'll be right back with the pitching ninja, Rob Friedman, next on The Score.